We are going to start the meeting again. I don't have a quorum here yet.
Yep.
Oh, yes, we do. We have a quorum now, so I can officially start the meeting. You all feel a bit more official now? We will begin by approving the minutes of Monday, March 23rd. Representative Daniels, would you? Representative Daniels has moved the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We have approved the minutes. We have several bills today and a couple of funding requests that we don't have bills for, and a couple of things that I will also maybe kind of include as I go along, depending on how I feel. First bill, House File 1967, which, by the way, Representative Nornes, was a very good year. It was. So, Representative Nornes.
Where were you in 1967?
High school. High school.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Nornes.
Thanks for the opportunity to present House File 1967. You need to officially move it. Do you do that in this committee?
Yes. I'll move House File 1967.
Okay. To be included?
That it be included. Move possible inclusion. It's been a week. For possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Okay. Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair and members, this is a rather simple bill. Has no request for funding. What it deals with is the special event recreational camping permit that's required right now by the state of Minnesota. And organizations like you'll hear from in a couple of minutes, it creates a hardship. And these organizations get together because they have a common interest. And it's pretty much, let's say, a low-budget operation. Just friends getting together to do something they all mutually enjoy. I'd like to turn the testimony over to Al Frank, who is a constituent of mine from Perkins Falls, and he can explain the situation.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Identify yourself for the tape, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Al Frank. I'm from Perkins Falls, Minnesota. And I'm here to speak on behalf of House File 1967.
Thank you. Welcome and begin.
Okay. I did send an email to each of the committee members along with two documents earlier in March, knowing that this bill was going to be coming to your committee. The importance of this bill to my organization, which is Black Powder Club. There are several Black Powder Clubs throughout the state of Minnesota. I want to say 33 or 35 of them. And what that is it's a group of people that do historical reenactment. They do Black Powder shooting competitions, primitive archery competition, and tomahawk and knife throwing competitions, and the dress at that time is just like you went back in history to pre-1840. You go into a Black Powder camp, it's like you step back in history. And it's a family-oriented situation. It's not something that is gaining money. We're not raising money.
Now, Mr. Frank, are they percussion or flintlock?
Both. So I don't need to explain a whole lot about Black Powder shooting. You have an indication of what it's about. And it's not the inline. It's totally primitive. But we had a situation that brought this to our attention last year. Our club has been in existence. We'll be celebrating our 35th anniversary rendezvous this year. Last year, where we have our camp is on city property in the city of Perham. And for as long as we've been there, the lease agreement has been a handshake and a word of mouth. But in today's society, that's kind of changing, and they wanted something in writing. So we worked up our lease, and in their cover letter, they said, be sure and have your state permit for camping. And we had no idea what that was. And come to find out that under 327.14, subdivision 9, recreational camping we had to have the State Department of Health come and look at the grounds at a cost of $400. Then they say you can or can't have it at this location, and the $400 is there whether you can or can't. They keep it. On top of that $400, if they say, yeah, you can have it, then you pay a fee plus a fee for each additional camp. So it cost our club last year $650. That we don't make that kind of money. It's simple as that. So I did the research on this special event camping, and it is painted with such a broad brush that if any one of you had property that you owned in the country, on a lake, in acreage, and you were going to have a family reunion, and say you had 20, 25 people coming, more than what you could have in your house, you say, oh, hey, I've got this acreage. You all like to camp. Bring your camper, bring your tent, whatever. Set it up. I got plenty of room. You're subject to that $400 inspection plus the camp fee, believe it or not. Anytime you have more than five camps together for no more than two times annually for less than 14 consecutive days, you're subject to that $400 inspection fee plus whatever camp fees for the amount of people you have. That not only affects our black powder people, but I know of several places throughout the state where they have threshing reunions, county fairs. The carnies camp at these county fairs. I know of one county fair that advertises camping. They've got to have it, and they don't. I've talked to some people that I asked if they would assist me in trying to get this law changed or this bill passed, and they really want to see it, but, you know, they haven't caught us yet, so we'll keep our head down. Please don't turn us in. And that, you just shouldn't have to look at it that way. You just shouldn't.
So if a few dozen people came for a family reunion on a private property?
Yes.
And five of them camped overnight?
Yep. Yep. That's under subdivision 9, and I have researched it, and it is true. As a matter of fact, when we were working on getting our license, the gentleman from the state that I worked with through the State Department of Health was retiring, and he was pretty blunt with me. He said, are you going to keep trying to get this law changed? And I says, yeah. He says, well, I shouldn't say this because I'm retiring. He says, but I hope you do, because it's a pain in the for us. So, and I'll entertain any questions that I haven't been clear on.
Well, thank you. Any comments or questions from members? Representative Murphy.
Who gets the money from the camping licenses?
Well, it's paid to the Department of Health.
Okay. Is there somebody from the Department of Health here?
I was going to ask if there is anyone from the Department of Health or anyone in the audience who has a concern that would like to speak. I don't see anybody. Any Representative Nornes, do you have any further comments?
I was just going to add, I would, maybe the reason they're not here is that the amount of money that we're looking to probably deal with that's not going to be collected anymore is relatively small.
Yeah. But
Representative Kahn.
Of course, I didn't hear all of this, so I'm sorry if I'm mistaken, but I don't see how this would cover the event that we would that he was just talking about. Why would this? Why would that cover?
Mr. Representative Nornes?
I think the example of a family reunion probably is not covered in this.
Yes, that's what I
But it's, it is a fact that that is still a requirement.
Yeah, I know, but
we're
the
this
is not covered.
We're addressing the historical reenactments,
okay.
But I just wanted to point out how broad a brush stroke this law covers.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you. So we would need a family reunion advocate to bring this up?
I don't
up.
Know that that is appropriate for the legacy committee. Maybe it is. It depends how broadly you define legacy, Mr. Chairman.
You saw my family, you would.
But my point is that there are so many organizations that have this historical culture that there should be some exemptions for them like there is in the other part of the statute.
Oh, Mr. Frank, I actually do have one in my district where we have a yearly rendezvous at the Forest City Stockade, and we have Black Powder shooting, and they all camp out. And I don't know if they've been paying a permit. But this would take care of them.
Yes, it would.
All right. Further discussion. Representative Murphy?
Is there individual campground? Is there individual preparation of food at the things that you're talking about? Or is there a collective preparation of food where you're talking?
It's just like you camp by yourself. Everybody takes care of their own food.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Murphy E.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just one question about the bill itself and whether or not this needs to be heard anywhere else, if this is really limited just to legacy or how it's being dealt with in the Senate. And maybe you don't know that.
I don't know.
A broader issue, especially if there's a potential fiscal impact at the Department of Health.
I think if someone else wants to hear it, they'll let me know.
Really?
But I haven't been informed that I needed to pass this on any other place. So, anything else? Other than if there is not, we will renew Representative Nornes's or Representative Daniels' motion.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Since this affects a policy that Health has had, doesn't it seem that it ought to go there, even if they're not here?
Representative Freiberg.
I was just going to say I do serve on the Health Reform Committee, and in that committee we did hear a bill related to lodging establishments that seems kind of, and people were talking about why are we hearing this here, but then the nonpartisan staff did specify that these are requirements, I mean, because they relate to licensing, food preparation, sanitation, things like that within the Department of Health, so seems like this might be comparable.
Okay. All right. Well, Representative Freiberg, I think what we'll do then, in light of these questions, is we're just going to lay the bill over in our committee, and if someone wants to hear this, if another committee wants it, we'll have that discussion and allow them to have it. So, I will lay this bill over for possible inclusion, and we will confer with the DHS and see if we need to send it any other place.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Which bill are we going to do next?
All right. The next bill before us, again, I'm moving around in the agenda here today, but it is the next one on this agenda, and we do not have a bill, but we have a funding request for the Great Lakes Aquarium, and we'll hear testimony regarding that. And I believe that's Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The Great Lakes Aquarium is an important educational center and visitor attraction on the bayfront of Duluth, Minnesota. The focus of the aquarium has been on the North American Great Lakes and other large lakes around the world. Every museum and every educational center always needs new visitors and new things to educate the public about. And they do this through displays and expertise about things. If you could see on a monthly basis the impact that the shipwrecks display had, which was the first big new display since the aquarium opened, you would see why they're thinking of another display that's very well needed for the public to visit and the people to learn from. And the people from the Great Lakes Aquarium is here today, and they know the subject much better than I do. But that shipwreck display is worth a visit to Bayfront in Duluth, to the Great Lakes Aquarium. Jack LaVoie is a director. Former Representative LaVoie was here before my time. And he's in his autumn years of directing at the Lake Superior Center, but he is as enthusiastic and informative as he ever was, even when he was a state representative. And he's a constituent of mine. And so he and Sarah are going to tell you about their needs.
Mr. LaVoie.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Murphy, and members of the committee for inviting us to share our story and introduce you to a new opportunity we are developing.
You identify yourself in your title.
As Representative Murphy said, I'm Jack LaVoie. I'm Executive Director at Lake Superior Center doing business as Great Lakes Aquarium in Duluth. And I'm joined here today by our Education Director, Sarah Erickson, who will be helping me with this presentation. This slide provides you with a snapshot look at our history. First incorporated as a nonprofit in 1989, Lake Superior Center became a public corporation by an act of legislature in 1990 with a focus on freshwater education and opened in the year 2000. Our annual revenue is around $1.9 million. We have an attendance average of around 125,000 people per year, making us the most popular paid attraction in Duluth. Annually, we serve about 10,000 students in structured educational program, primarily on-site, but also through outreach. We operate the facility with 20 full-time people. It's a very lean operation, and 6 part-timers with the help of about 100-plus volunteers. In the past 7 years, we've focused on enhancing the visitor's experience, and during that time, we've invested more than $1.5 million in new exhibits and updates to existing ones. New exhibits such as the Amazing Amazon, Freshwater Forest, Fire, Ice, and the Rise of Life, plus Aquatic Invaders, Global Connections, and most recently, the most fantastic exhibit to date, Shipwrecks Alive, have successfully contributed to a dramatic increase in aquarium memberships and annual visitor attendance. And we're very grateful to this committee and the legislators for past funding for the Shipwrecks Alive exhibit. It's been a great success and brought a diverse group of community partners together. The exhibit opened in July of 2014 to rave reviews, and since that time, more than 80,000 people have toured the exhibit and learned about the fascinating world under the waves. This gives you a glimpse into the gallery. The exhibit's located in a changeable gallery that houses new exhibits every few years. It features three feature exhibits comparing the habitat created by unique shipwrecks. The SS America, which is interpreted on your left, the Ghost Fleet of Truk Lagoon in the South Pacific, which is the coral reef you see to your right, and an ancient Roman merchant shipwreck in the Mediterranean. It features live animal displays, hands-on interactives, video tours of the shipwreck environments, and artifacts in an underwater-themed exhibit hall. The $200,000 in funding we received from the Legacy Fund was leveraged by some $232,000 to complete this project. This includes $50,000 in matching funds from the City of Duluth Tourism Tax Fund and a $182,000 cash and in-kind match from Great Lakes Aquarium's operating budget. Each day, interpretive programs engage visitors with animal feedings, the habitat featured, and the stories hidden under the waves. The project brought together partners from around the state, Great Lakes region, and the world. The Great Lakes Shipwreck Preservation Society, Thunder Bay Marine Sanctuary, an aquarium in Australia, Lake Superior Magazine, and Duluth-based artists and artisans all contributed to this project's success. The exhibit aligned perfectly with our mission to provide people with opportunities to explore the connection to Lake Superior and waters of the world. Education is at the core of our work and was our charge by the legislature as Lake Superior Center was established to focus on freshwater education. Here you see children dressed up as part of the Lake Superior food web as they explore their own backyards. We provide experiences for all ages that are authentic and personal and support hands-on discovery. Each year we work with more than 10,000 youth on-site and through outreach, and this number continues to grow. For instance, this summer we are bringing on additional educators to help us increase our camp and preschool offerings to better serve our community. And this shows you. We are also a community gathering place and are becoming more and more the destination of choice for a wide range of groups to meet, share ideas, and collaborate. This spring, yet another example of investment in our mission and community is being made. In the past few years, we have raised $410,000, mostly from private sector individuals and organizations, to build three new classrooms and a teacher resource center that houses free lendable kits for schools and offers professional development opportunities for students and teachers. Currently, our classrooms and meeting rooms occupy space on the first floor. The new classrooms have moved to the Discovery Center in June. It will open up more than 3,000 square feet of future gallery space overlooking the Duluth Harbor. This represents an amazing opportunity. After visioning sessions with our board of directors, staff, and community members, it became clear that we should use this newly available space to develop a new exhibit focused on large lakes of the world. Our location, our community, and our region make this a natural fit. So now I'd like to call on our education director, Sarah Erickson, to give you an overview of our vision for this exciting new exhibit opportunity in Duluth.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Erickson. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Thanks for having us. I'm Sarah Erickson. I'm the education director at Great Lakes Aquarium in Duluth. And as Jack mentioned, we're really poised in Duluth. We're really at the epicenter of freshwater exploration, and paired with our 15 years of exhibit designing experience and experience designing, we are ready to tackle this next project. We're a valued partner in the sciences, in the arts, and in the teaching and learning communities in the Twin Ports and across the Great Lakes and really across throughout the state. The exhibit, we invite the legislature to collaborate with us on recalling the amazing world of the unsalted seas. So I'd like to give you a glimpse at what those seas look like today. There are more than 253 lakes that are considered large lakes throughout the world. These lakes are more than 500 square kilometers in surface area and hold about two-thirds of the liquid freshwater that's found on the planet. So just to give you a few. Lake Superior, of course, is near and dear to our region's heart for water and weather, recreation, and our economy. It's one of five of the Laurentian Great Lakes. Lake Biwa is in Japan. Some of the same fish occupy our waters here in Minnesota as Lake Biwa. One of the interesting twists, however, is things like bluegill and largemouth bass are actually considered invasive and are destructive to this Lake Biwa community. Lake Baikal is the most biodiverse lake in the world. It's located in Russia. with more than 2,000 species and hundreds of endemic species that are found nowhere else on the planet. This includes things like freshwater seals and whole communities of freshwater sponges. So this is what it looks like on the surface. But under the water, this is what it looks like under the ice. These are freshwater sponges. Lake Malawi is one of the African rift lakes. It's known for its unique cichlid populations. Many folks have these in their home aquariums. This lake is one of the oldest in the world and is the focus of research done at Large Lakes Observatory, located in Duluth. Lake Tanganyika is another of the African lakes. It's the longest lake in the world, and it's home to things like spotted neck otters, which are close relative to the North American river otters we have living here in our waters. Lake Victoria is another of the African rift lakes, home to things like hippos, which are charismatic.
I have to comment on that one.
Sure.
I once spent a few nights on the shores of Lake Victoria, and I was informed it was also the most polluted lake in Africa.
It definitely has some challenges, and that's part of the story we're hoping to tell.
And I remember our host served us dinner, and it was fresh fish. I said, "Where do these fish come from?" And he said, "The Lake Victoria." And then I thought, let's see, most polluted lake in Africa, and there it is right in front of me, the fish from the most polluted lake in Africa, and what should I do? Oh, I've got a toothache. I can't eat. And I didn't. My wife did. She got sick. But anyway, my brief digression from my Lake Victoria story. You may continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sounds like you have a personal connection to the story. Lake Nicaragua is in Central America, and it's home to species that are typically considered marine species, things like bull sharks and sawfish. And the Caspian Sea is actually one of the salt lakes in the world, and it's a much lower salt concentration than that found in the ocean. It's home to the famous beluga sturgeon, which is a threatened fish, and also the main source of the prized caviar that folks enjoy. We are hoping to tell the story of these 253 lakes from around the world through four main themes. We're working on freshwater resources, looking at the idea that sustainable use of fresh water is key to the future of human civilization on Earth. We're looking at large lake science, trying to demonstrate and engage visitors with just how and why science is used to understand these lakes. Many of the same techniques used in ocean spaces are used on these large lakes. And we're looking at how large lakes are evolutionary hotspots and display a range of biodiversity based on lake age and location. And climate change. These large lakes record and display the effects of past and modern climate change in unique ways. This is a visualization of what the gallery might look like when completed. We have a feature exhibit that will invite visitors to interact with one of the Great Lakes' iconic species, the lake sturgeon. This experience will provide a unique entry point to engage the public on all of the topics addressed in the gallery. Visitors will engage with the sturgeon and learn about sturgeon all around the world. The low-profile tank preserves the dramatic views of the Duluth Superior Harbor, and we'll be using theming to really transform visitors to a new space. This is a floor plan. It's also in the booklet you received from us of how we hope to use this space. On your right-hand side is the deck that overlooks the Duluth Superior Harbor. So really trying to engage folks with that working waterfront and connecting them to waters of the world. So what will it take to make this project a reality? I'm going to hand it back to Jack to explain more about the budget and timelines. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Representative LaVoy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're looking at a $726,500 project to completely transform this 3,300 square feet overlooking the bay. One of the largest expenditures is the gallery preparation. That area used to house education offices and our old classrooms. And so the floor isn't sufficiently strong enough to hold these large tanks filled with water without some structural work to improve them. And so that's the largest expenditure at $215,000. The biodiversity exhibit, which will feature the cichlids and lakes from Africa, $58,600. Freshwater resources, climate change, lake science, the sturgeon touch tank, $184,000, and then a video introducing the public to large lakes from around the world for a total of $726,000. We're asking for $325,000 in legacy funding, which we hope to match with $200,000 from other sources, plus another $201,000 from our own operation budgets, for a total of $726,500. Duluth is a logical place for this kind of an exhibit. We not only have a Great Lakes, the only Great Lakes Aquarium in North America in Duluth, but we're also the home to the Large Lakes Observatory at UMD, the EPA Mid-Continent EPA Lab, the estuary program over at the UWS in Superior. And so we have a lot of critical mass in the community that we can draw upon as a resource to make this exhibit the spectacular thing we hope it will be. With that, I'm willing to open up for any questions you might have.
Well, thank you. I see that you had about 125,000 in attendance. Do you have any projections on what you think that could grow to if you make these improvements?
Well, I have to tell you, we're having a phenomenal year. The first week of this month was 60% above the same week a year before. December, January, February, and March are each 50% above the same 4 months a year before. We've been growing, and I think Shipwrecks has been a major contributor toward that. And so I wouldn't be surprised to reach 130,000 this year. And I think by bringing this gallery in and actually opening the first floor of the aquarium up to that beautiful harbor view with the aerial lift bridge and canal park on one side and ship traffic going by your front door is going to have a phenomenal impact. I truly believe that. Then we have the additional opportunity. The Discovery Center, which we actually started construction on yesterday, is going to create space for not only the three classrooms, but a daytime meeting space where we can handle 100 groups of 100 to 120 or more in a daytime setting overlooking the bay. And that's going to provide us with daytime rental opportunities we've never had in the past. So we think both all of these things combined, Shipwrecks Alive, the unsalted, the amazing world of the unsalted seas, and the opening of our new Discovery Center are going to have a huge impact.
Okay. Members? Questions? Comments? Anyone else have any questions or comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I did want to add that there is a House File 2060, which has been referred to this committee.
And Mr. Chairman, I believe in their packets we did have a booklet that sort of talks more about this opportunity in narrative form with some of the same pictures you saw, but a little more of an in-depth explanation that I hope you'll have to take a chance to look over.
Okay, thank you. And even though we don't physically have House File 2060 in front of us, we will lay the contents of it over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney, House File 896. Representative Mahoney, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's, I think, the first time I've been in front of the Legacy Committee, so happy to be here, and hopefully you'll move my bill for possible inclusion. Is that what you're doing?
Yes, that's what it'll be. You know, welcome. Your life is complete now. You've made it to the Legacy Committee. And
and I learned a little bit about old guns today.
Yes. And I will... move House File 896 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have with me Mr. Bill Zychek, who has been a mover on the Chinese Garden. I'll go over the bill and present it, and then he can talk a little bit.
Okay.
But while I'm doing that, this should be in your packet. Gives a lot of information. It's one of the It was a PowerPoint, and I don't know how to use the computer well enough to do it, so I just printed it out for you. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm going to break this down into five general areas. Why I'm here, what's the significance of the Chinese Garden, the relationship of the sister cities, the element of the garden itself, and if you're looking for that, there are a number of pictures of other Chinese gardens in this handout. And then we'll talk a little bit about the sponsors and collaborators on this particular Chinese garden. What I'm doing is seeking funds for the design of the garden and the design of the Changsha Chinese Friendship Garden at Phelan Park in St. Paul, which happens to be in my district. But actually, I think the garden might be in Lily's district, but it's pretty close to either one of ours. Depends on where the road ends up. This is part of the 2011 Phelan Keller Regional Master Plan. We started doing that in 2007 or 2008 and was authorized by the City Council in 2011. The Chinese Garden is a sister city project with the city of Changsha in Hunan Province in China. And with the collaboration of the sculptor, I'm going to probably slaughter this man's name, Li Yi Chang, who created the statue Meditation, which is in the park, and he also created the Martin Luther King Jr. Stone of Hope in D.C. The idea originated with the Chinese Friendship Society, and we have done a lot of extensive research and planning to this particular point. This garden would be part of the restoration of Phelan Park in this area. We have restored the Stone Arch Bridge from my childhood that I managed to avoid getting any speeding tickets as I went around Lake Phelan, which was designed to be a racetrack rather than an actual parkway, but we have since changed that. The channel improvements that we did a couple years ago, we now get a cleaner, fresher water coming through that chain of lakes, and it is a chain of five lakes, and then the waterfall restoration at Phelan, and we are using water from the lake rather than from groundwater. One of the reasons for needing these funds to complete the schematic drawings and plans is we are trying to get corporate and foundation sponsorship for this, to pay for part of this. And as the Friendship Garden Group goes around to these organizations, they say, well, show us, what's the plan? Where is your plan? And they say, well, we're trying to raise money to create the plan. And they say, well, we don't fund plans. We fund projects. We fund things that we can actually point to and say we did. So we're coming to the legislature here for this $50,000 to put together the schematics and the plans. And we have some fundraising sources already privately so that we can cover any cost overruns there. The significance of this garden, it would be the first Chinese garden in Minnesota. We now have eight at this present time. We have no Chinese gardens, even though China is, depending on the year, one of our top three trading partners with Minnesota. Some years it's one, some years it's three, some years it's even been two. There is a huge ethnic diversity in St. Paul, and 31% of the people in the Payne-Phelan neighborhood are of Asian descent. We have the largest Hmong concentration outside of Laos in America, here I think it is, and Changsha in Hunan province is kind of the historical home about 1,000 to 1,500 years ago of the Hmong. So that's kind of where that that relationship came from. The sister city relationship has been in existence for 25 years. It was started by George Latimer in 1987. We've had numerous delegations traveling between the two cities. And we last time one of the delegations from Changsha was here, we kind of toured the site that we were looking at putting, and they were very thrilled at the idea. And just to give you some background of Changsha, It is a city of over 6 million people, situated on a major river, much like St. Paul, and is a huge port for the interior of China. And it's about a 3,000-year-old city. The elements of the Chinese garden, and again, I'll point you to this here. I think it's fifth or eighth page in there. It shows some of the architectural styles that are in a Chinese garden: the terraces, the pagoda, the decorative rock, and the cricks, and the bridges that typically go into one of these type of gardens. I guess there's also something called a short dragon wall, and I know that's in there because I've seen it. Now, we do a lot of things that tie itself into the Asian culture at Phelan. It's a park that gets a million visitors a year. A significant number of them are of Asian descent, and we have we put together the meditation statue. We've kind of designed some of the facilities there. We have the dragon boat races there. We have a whole number of things that go on there that kind of try to draw the community into the park. Parks are always safer when you have more people, and people are healthier when they use the parks. I've spoken a lot for most of my presentations. I want to assure you that we have community support, and that's what my testifier, Bill Zajcek, will testify to, talk a little bit about, maybe even show a little bit of the pictures that he has, and then we will open itself up for questions.
Thank you. Mr. Zajcek, would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yeah, my name is William Zajcek, and I'm a resident on the east side of St. Paul. I'm also on the Payne-Phelan District 5 Planning Council, and they are definitely supporting this endeavor. We're working with the Friendship Garden Society to try to make this happen in Parks and Rec. And I was actually on the task force for putting together the master plan for Phelan back in 2009-2010, and when this idea first became a possibility. And of the three or four new ideas for the park, this was by far the most exciting one. And since then, it's gotten hung up on the fact that Parks and Rec simply doesn't have the money to do the design. Without a design, we can't get the funding. So that's kind of where we're stuck right now. We've been working with Friendship Garden, with Parks and Rec. And Tim Mahoney.
Yeah.
And Senator Fonghara. And in fact, the senator, he was the one that pointed out to me that Changsha was the ancestral home of the Hmong, because he recently attended a convention in Changsha with the ancestors of the Hmong. So there's still air. There's still people living around the Changsha area. So this connection is sort of fortuitous in a lot of ways. And I think we're going to have a very good involvement with the Hmong population with this. And we've also, we're attempting to get funding from other sources in case this doesn't work out for the design. We're working with the CIB process in the city of St. Paul, and members of the Friendship Garden Society are willing to put up money as well. But basically, this is the chunk we need to get started. So here's the sculpture meditation at Phelan. And this is Weiming Liu, who is a developer in downtown St. Paul. He's got a picture of what the pavilion would look like on the opposing embankment across from the stream behind the meditation station. So I hope we have your support and we can get this funding to move forward.
Oh, thank you. This brings the discussion, brings up thoughts of a meeting we had a week or so ago with Representative Lilly's bill. Would there be room for a Hmong playing field there?
Actually, the Hmong are already using the island. There's a moat around an island that runs the channel underneath the stone bridge out in Lake Phelan, and and that island is already used for that purpose. So I'm not sure what kind of playing field she's looking for.
Does anyone remember the name of the...
Tulu, T-U-J-L-U-P.
Is it that bamboo ball thing? Yes.
Well, it's like a top.
Spinning top.
Oh, a spinning top. There would be.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Representative Mahoney?
Actually, Ramsey County has a couple of fields that they're looking to do that are within the physical confines of the regional park, the Phelan-Keller Regional Park. There are what Bill was talking about, I thought this was in the packet, but I'm not sure if it is. Mm-hmm. This particular island, it's relatively interesting. Phelan is a very large park, and the Hmong community, the 16 to 21-year-old kids, all of a sudden descend on a particular place. They bring volleyball nets, and they play volleyball. Sometimes with their hands and sometimes with their feet, which is kind of interesting for an old guy like me to watch as they try to kill themselves kicking the ball over the net. But they do have a variety of games that they play in the park, and it's not unusual to find a half a dozen of these areas or these groups of kids playing in the park any particular night during the summer, which... frankly, if I can get 100 to 200 kids playing in the park versus driving their cars somewhere or getting in trouble somewhere, I think it's a great idea.
Okay, thank you. Comments, questions? Anyone? Well, any closing comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, this would be an absolute fabulous addition. It would draw more people into the park, which is always the goal of a big park like this. And it would could be used very easily, seeing as Central China is one of the next big areas where we'll be sending lots of exports to, that when they come here, we can show that this is part of our culture also and use it as part of the selling point of St. Paul, Minneapolis, Minnesota, for the exports and the imports from China.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will lay over House File 896 for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Our next item. Funding request for the Duluth Children's Museum. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Cameron Bloom Kruger. I'm the president and CEO of the Duluth Children's Museum. With me today is Michael Garcia, our senior consultant and formerly the retired president and CEO of the Duluth Children's Museum. And I'd like to begin by thanking you for all of your past support. I know the Duluth Children's Museum has been a part of legacy since the inception of the bill, and we really feel like it's a generous component of how we're able to operate our facility. I'd like to begin actually by having Michael talk a bit about our history and how we got to be here today.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Michael Garcia. As Cameron indicated, I am the immediate retired CEO and president, and I am the outgoing senior consultant. This legislative session is one of my last duties and responsibilities for the museum. However, I have been involved there for over 30 years as a volunteer board member, community advocate, and donor to the museum. The last 12 years have been serving on staff.
Well, thank you, Mr. Garcia. Welcome to the committee. As always, good to have you here. And continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, the history of the Duluth Children's Museum is unusual in our country. The Duluth Children's Museum was actually established in 1930 during the Great Depression by an art teacher, Mabel McKinney Wing, had gone out to New York City to teach, and she had the opportunity to observe the Children's Museum in Brooklyn. She came back to Duluth, interestingly enough, upon ill health, which is the reason for my retirement, and she went to the school district, and she persuaded them to give her an empty classroom in the Salter School building in Duluth, Minnesota. In 1930, there were only four other children's museums either in existence or in development in the United States. So Duluth was actually at the forefront of a movement that today is one of the largest and growing areas of cultural expansion in the country. The reason for this is that children's museums serve the interests and the needs of some of the youngest citizens of our country. And they also serve the interests and the needs of children who are often on the edge or on the fringe of society and on the fringe of finding a connection in their community. Organizations like the Duluth Children's Museum, through support from the Legacy Amendment, are organizations that are built on rich and strong collaboration and partnership. I had the privilege and the honor of serving on the Framework and Vision Committee after the amendment was passed. And in that committee work, 11 of us from across the state of Minnesota tried to articulate both the outcomes and some vision for the 25-year effect of the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. In so doing, we talked about several things, but one of the consistent themes of the committee's work was increasing partnerships across cultural organizations in Minnesota. One of the things that we knew, and one of the things our handout documents for you, is that having adequate resources is really an essential part of establishing deep and meaningful partnerships that actually go on to have an impact on the organization. I'm very proud and pleased that the Duluth Children's Museum has established partnerships since the Legacy Amendment funding started for the museum 6 years ago with the Minnesota Humanities Center, the Minnesota Historical Society, the Arrowhead Regional Arts Council in Duluth, the Arrowhead Regional Library Association, the Duluth Public Library, Minnesota Children's Museum, the State Arts Board, the Science Museum Minnesota, and the Headwaters Science Center, just to mention a few of them. All of them are examples of where legacy investments have expanded opportunities for local programming in the Duluth area and Duluth community. Additionally, in the time since the first legacy funding happened, the Duluth Children's Museum took a bold move. Before the legacy amendment, we had purchased a building on Helm Street in West Duluth that we hope will become the permanent home of the Duluth Children's Museum. In the last year, we've made significant progress towards that goal, in part because of the investment of the Legacy Committee and the fiscal strength that the museum has achieved. The museum received its first time in the history of 83 years a $1 million gift from an individual donor whose interest it is to see the Children's Museum expand and go in perpetuity and into future generations of service. We are very pleased with that progress and that growth, but we were also given the opportunity by the Zeppa Family Foundation, the Clyde Development Corporation, to consider relocating to a Phase 1 building just 25 feet from our permanent home in Clyde Park. We took that enormous leap, and after 36 years of occupying space in a county-owned building, the historic Union Depot, the Children's Museum became part of Clyde Park and the Lincoln Park community. That move tripled the public space for programming and direct service. It also provided free parking for families with young children who came and didn't necessarily know how long they were going to stay. It gave us touchpad entrances on both doors of the museum, and it provided restrooms on both floors, which we didn't enjoy in the old historic Union Depot. Very important things when you're carrying young children with you. The Children's Museum has prospered in large part from your support and from your investment. It serves thousands of children annually, and it has expanded its program initiative to include a strong commitment building on the arts and cultural history heritage of the museum to include STEM initiatives. In the last 2 years, we've worked with the Amateur Radio and the International Space Station program. We've had a SSEP program, which is the students, and we passed out the press release from that. Students from Marshall High School will have their experiment go on the International Space Station. We have continued to expand our STEM initiative to reach early childhood through a national collaborative that the Science Museum of Minnesota is a regional provider in, that's known as NISNET, a nanoscale informal educational experience. That's what we've done. We've made enormous strides with your help and your support. Children's Museum also in 1988 passed a resolution at that time supporting the creation of this amendment. So we have had a long history both on this topic and with the success of the funding in bringing that funding home and to have a direct impact on our constituents. I'm very pleased and proud to be able to hand it off to Cameron Bloom Kruger, not only in this presentation, but in the leadership of the museum. The board, 2 years ago when my health failed, became challenged by finding a new director and appointing a new person, and I have been on the fringes, watching things happen, keeping my foot in the door as invited. But at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Cameron and allow him to talk about what the next 2 years of funding will allow us to do. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee, I brought with me today my son, Blaze, and he's in the audience here. And I'm using him as an example. I've warned him of this, only to say that I grew up in the Duluth Children's Museum. My son, Blaze, grew up in the Duluth Children's Museum. We've both grown and aspired to leadership, and I do feel like our museum provides those kinds of opportunities to individuals in this community, especially those who so desperately need it in out-of-school time, in after-school programming. When you're not in a classroom being provided with formal education, the Duluth Children's Museum is there. As a component of that, we have our Passport for Culture program, which allows individuals from the community who are not able to afford our admission rates or membership to still access the museum through membership. And that is an absolutely important part of what we do. We believe that we're an organization for every person to be able to access all the things that we do, from STEM education to informal learning, history, and culture. I started December 1st, which means that I'm fairly new to leadership of the museum and have had a high learning curve over what it means to run both an informal learning environment with claiming and play structures, as well as science education, as well as a collection of 35,000 historical and cultural artifacts that the museum was founded on. And what I found right off the bat is that there are three areas of focus that we're looking at as an organization. I've done a significant amount of community surveying, as well as focus groups and individual conversations with constituents, stakeholders, individuals who appreciate our organization. What I know is that we need to be changing up what we're doing, which means providing more educational outreach opportunities, providing new and innovative learning environments within our facility. Since moving to our phase one site, many of our standing exhibits have remained the same, and it's time to change those up and provide new opportunities. We also believe that we need to provide an excellent guest experience that everybody talks about. And we believe that from the time that you get out of your car and walk in the door to the time that you get back to your car, not only have you received quite a lot of enriching learning, but you've had a great time. And we believe that that is what gets kids excited about learning, what makes them want to come back and learn the next time, and really works well with what we're doing in our organization. And the third piece is re-energizing our capital efforts. We have this building, the Helm Street building, that is an absolutely gorgeous space and just needs a facelift, which is going to require some capital efforts. And we believe that by re-energizing that campaign, we can provide for Duluth the Children's Museum that we really deserve in our community. I had mentioned our cultural artifacts, 35,000, which makes us the smallest children's museum in the country to be collections-based from our formation, and is really a large part of why we're an educational facility and not just a playground. And I've actually brought today a Civil War journal, and after our legacy hearing, I'd love to share that with you if you'd like to see it, especially as educators and historians in the room here. I know that you'll find that to be a fascinating piece, but it's one very small piece of such an enormous collection of what we provide. And we'll make this a little more memorable for you by having you take a look at it. I'm thinking of you, Chairman Erdl, as well.
Thank you.
I knew you'd be fascinated. It's for you. It really is. Our biennial request is $650,000 for the biennium, $325,000 annually, and that is for enriching and enhancing and providing us with further opportunity for expanding our outreach and changing up what we're providing within our programming space to provide an even deeper and more enriching opportunity for children to learn, as well as providing direct sensory experiences. With that, we would welcome any questions, and I want to thank you again so much for all of your support over the years.
Thank you. First question I have really has nothing to do with, you know, how much funding you would get from us, but just a question. So what type of education training do you need to take this position? I mean, do you have a degree in children's museums, or how does that work?
Well, part of the reason why the board selected me is I have a background in nonprofit management, a master's in organizational leadership. I've worked with 125 nonprofits throughout northeastern Minnesota doing capacity building, and my thesis was actually on capacity building, so how to take an organization from their current place to a much higher, deeper place.
Okay, thank you. Other comments, questions? Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I am wondering if you can talk a little bit more about the frog embryos going into space and what the hypothesis of the students is.
I would love to.
Mr.
So
Kruger.
It's actually, Mr. Chair. The experiment was based on some research that had initially been done where they found that by hatching the frog embryos in a low Earth orbit or low gravity environment, that the frogs, the baby frogs, actually had deformities. So they are doing some further testing on that to expand upon this initial research and find out whether or not this is actually the case. And so once those are brought into the International Space Station, once they're back on Earth, those Marshall students actually have the opportunity to examine the embryos themselves, as well as the scientific community in general, and see whether or not those changes have been made.
Mr. Garcia.
If I could elaborate also, Mr. Chairman, Representative, one of the interesting pieces of the SSEP program and the link to the Duluth Children's Museum that is so unique was that was the first time in the history of that program where students competed to have their experiments go on the International Space Station, where a non-school-based entity was chosen to submit, to organize in their community and to submit potential student projects. This happens across the country, and this was the first initiative in Minnesota, and we were the first organization to make that application. The International Space Station team and the organization behind SSSP were very excited, but were very challenged by providing a CBO, a community-based organization, the opportunity to work with formal education to facilitate this. And it required that partnerships and schools agree to allow the children to pursue the experiments at every grade level involving 600 to 700 students when the opportunity wasn't even announced till the 10th of September and the timeline required it to be completed by November. Those of you who have done classroom teaching know that's a pretty unrealistic time frame, and it was an amazing community response, and for one of our local student groups to be one of three selected is outstanding.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we have another bill author waiting to have a bill heard, so I won't elaborate, but it doesn't surprise me that a group of Minnesota students would accomplish that. And I hope that when the students have their results, that this committee can see those when they're back.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
I just wanted to make the comment that I grew up in the Brooklyn Children's Museum, so it's one better. Or one older, whatever.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Any other comments or questions from anyone? Well, then, thank you for coming today, and this proposal will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Enjoy your retirement, Mr. Garcia.
Thank you, Chairman.
House File 1791, Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Anzell. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm joined this afternoon at the table by Mr. John Kelsch, who's the executive director of the Children's Museum in my community of Grand Rapids, a community in northern Minnesota, and a facility, a children's museum that serves almost a dozen counties and literally 30 or 40 different school districts and many, many more individual schools. Members, I'm a little embarrassed about one little part of this bill, and that is that I discovered about an hour ago and had a discussion with Chair Erdahl that the appropriation requests are wrong, and they're wrong by half. And I want to apologize for that. Those appropriations of $100,000 in fiscal year 16 and $100,000 in fiscal year 17 are what we are providing to the Grand Rapids Children's Museum today. And due to increased usage and the need for additional exhibits and to put our museum on a par with the other facilities in greater Minnesota, I respectfully ask the chair and the committee if you would consider an oral amendment to change those figures from 100 and 100 to 200 and 200.
Representative Zell, thank you. And this request did not reach us within 24 hours, but the chair has no objection to accepting this amendment if it is all right with the minority and other majority members. Is there any objection to allowing us to do this? Well then, I will move the amendment to on line 1-6 to change 100,000 in fiscal year 2016 and 100,000 in fiscal year 2017 to 200,000 in each instance. Any discussion on that amendment? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Could have been more enthusiastic, Representative Ansel, but it did pass.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members.
And at this point, then, I will move House File 1791 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
I can assure you, members and Mr. Chairman, that my community and the kids and the school districts and the parents who benefit from this great facility are greatly appreciative of your special action here today. With that, I'm going to ask Mr. Kelsch to give us just a brief description of our facility and a brief description of what we will do with these additional dollars if you are so moved to do so.
Thank you. Mr. Kelsch, identify yourself, please.
My name is John Kelsch. I'm the executive director of the Children's Discovery Museum in Grand Rapids, Minnesota.
And Mr. Kelsch, how long have you had that position?
I've been there for 21 years now.
So when I was there a few years ago, I saw you.
Yes. I'm the founding director. And we are tied to the Judy Garland Museum. We have the historic house, but our Children's Museum is separate. It has a much broader curriculum. I want to refer to our handout on the number of schools we've served now. In 14 years, our school service program has reached 166 different schools in our 10-county area from 77 different communities. So
pretty much every school student in your area has been to the museum.
Well, I couldn't say everyone, but it's getting close. We've had almost 80,000 enrolled on field trips in 14 years.
Well, I certainly think any school children who in the Grand Rapids area, you know, should go to the museum.
Yes, and well, when we started it, we knew that we didn't have enough kids in our county. We had to reach out to to the 10 counties. But more importantly, we track teacher comments, and you have a running average sheet where teachers rate our programs from nine questions, and five being the highest score, one being the lowest. And we consistently, most of our scores are the average greater than 4.5, which, you know, is pretty hard to beat. So we're very proud of that. We evaluate these results. Teachers also give us other feedback, and we incorporate that to improve our school program. We do need the extra money for new exhibits. Our core exhibits now are 14 years old. Nothing much has changed. We've added, you know, a few little minor adjustments, but in order to ensure a future audience, repeat visitors, members, and such, we really need to change out those core exhibits, which we do with that extra money over a two-year period. We're always looking for other sources of money as well. And I'm just going to end with a couple thoughts I've had. You know, all these numbers are great. Statistics look good. We're doing a great job. But did you know when they asked 50 Nobel Prize winners what was their greatest childhood influence? Most said having a meaningful experiences at a museum, because it made them ask questions and try to answer them. So that's what we do there. We take children off the bleachers and we put them in the game. We take them out of the audience and put them on the stage. We take them out of the classroom and put them in the world. Thank you very much, Chairman Erdahl and committee members.
Thank you, and Representative Kahn could again attest to the fact that visiting a children's museum at a young age can lead to great things.
Yes. I was going to add that to my comment. It's nice to make you, nice to have you do it.
Yeah. Comments or questions? I will say that I have attended the museum there, and I found it an entertaining, interesting museum.
Thank you. We're very proud of it.
Any other comments or questions? If not,
Mr. Chairman, if I may, once again, yes. I want to thank you for your special indulgence, and people of Grand Rapids are very pleased. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, and I will therefore renew my motion to include possibly House File 1791 in our omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. One more item on our agenda, and that is the I was getting to that. That's what I was going to say. The Representative Kahn with a hearing on monarch preservation. I really don't know what the Queen Elizabeth has to do with this, but come on. That was pretty good.
That was really obscure.
Well, monarch preservation.
Monarch, I got it.
All right.
Here all week, folks.
That's what happens when you have a learned historian conducting, acting as chair of the committee.
All right, we'll see. This is the interlude. They're taking a little time to set up, and Representative Kahn.
There's been a lot of discussion about the problems that we're having with pollinators and the problems we're having throughout the state, and I thought it was appropriate to hear from one of the real experts and to see what we can possibly on this committee do to help.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Karen Oberhauser. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Fisheries, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology. And I've been studying monarchs for 31 years. And I'm here today just to talk kind of generally about why it's worth the state of Minnesota investing resources in monarch conservation. I'm going to say they're a really interesting, unique species. Probably all of you have had an experience at some point in your life with a monarch butterfly. They make great connections between people and the natural world. Protecting monarchs would benefit a lot of other organisms, including pollinators that are so important to our health and well-being.
And finally, and maybe most importantly, we can do something about monarch conservation in our own backyards. This is a problem that can be solved. So I want to just talk a little bit about monarchs' life history. They have, what's really amazing about them is they have this incredible migratory cycle. Every fall, starting in late August and continuing through September, monarchs leave the state of Minnesota. They fly, they join monarchs from all over the eastern part of the United States. They funnel through Texas. They get to overwintering sites in Mexico. I don't know if this is a little, yeah. So you can see their overwintering sites right in central Mexico. They arrive there in late October and early November. They stay all winter long. There is a separate population in the western United States that migrates along the coast of California. And then starting in mid-March, so it's actually happening right now, monarchs have moved out of Mexico. They're moving into the southeastern United States. And then it's their offspring that continue the journey back to Minnesota and other places in the northern United States. So when you see a monarch in your backyard in the spring, it was not a monarch that was there in the fall, but it could be its daughter or its son. Then they go through 2 to 3 more non-migratory breeding generations during the summertime, and then the cycle starts again. So we have this annual life cycle. And during this period, when they cover this broad, broad area in the United States, they require different resources. So during the fall migration, they need nectar. They actually gain weight when they're making this long journey of a couple thousand miles. They need roosting trees that they spend evenings and nights on. They don't fly during the night. When they get to their overwintering sites in Mexico, and if you've never been there, I really encourage you to go at some point. It's really one of the amazing wonders of the world. I've read that there's no other density of animals like this in the world except krill in the Arctic Ocean. So krill and monarchs are where it's at. They stay in these overwintering sites, mostly just kind of hanging out in the trees for most of the winter, and then every once in a while you see these big bursts of them flying up into the air. When they're moving north in the spring, again, the adults need nectar to fuel their northern flight and to just stay alive, but they also need milkweed plants. So as the monarchs are flying north, they're laying their eggs on the little milkweed plants coming up. This is green milkweed in Texas that this female is laying an egg on. And then the really important part of the life cycle is getting up here into the north where they find a milkweed plant to lay an egg on. They go through these generations and the population builds up during the course of the summer. And then the cycle starts again. Now this is a chain. Every single link on the chain has to be there in order for this phenomenon to continue. But the basis of this chain is milkweed plants in the upper Midwest. Over half of the monarchs that migrate to Mexico every winter, and there are millions of them, come from milkweed plants basically in the Corn Belt. So that's this annual cycle. And the individual life cycle is pretty amazing in itself. Starts with an egg, kind of a chicken and an egg argument. You could say it starts with the adult, but I'm going to start with the egg. They only lay their eggs on milkweed plants, usually one egg at a time. The eggs hatch into the caterpillars or larvae. They're an egg for about 4 or 5 days, a caterpillar for 9 to 12 days, depending on temperature. During the time that they're a caterpillar, they grow from the little tiny one that you see on the right there, up to the great big one that you're probably more familiar with, about the size of your little finger if you're small. And during that time, they about 10 days, they increase their body mass by about 2,000 times. Then they pupate, so form the chrysalis stage. My graduate students always say that this is the best, their favorite stage of monarchs because there's no work in the lab. They don't have to be fed. They just sit there. And then we get to the adult, and the cycle again can start again. Now, like I said before, the basis of this is milkweed. Monarch females only lay their eggs on milkweed, usually just one egg. And on the top there, you see a little caterpillar just chewing its way out of its egg, which is about the size of a pinhead. Sometimes they'll lay more eggs on a milkweed plant, but usually, like you see in the bottom, but usually it's just one. And we've done some calculations in my lab using data from a lot of citizen scientists all over the country. We know that monarchs require lots of milkweed. So we've done calculations from people that are out there collecting data from us. And we've figured that it takes about 30 milkweed plants to produce an adult. Now, that's not because they eat so much. That's just because very few of them actually survive. So we have some predators that eat the adults. Here you see, and it's not the greatest picture, but in the upper left-hand corner you see a frog that actually caught a monarch and ate it. It's not a really important predator that we often think about with monarchs, but there you have it. The overwintering sites, there are birds that eat them. This is a mantid eating one in the bottom there. But most of the mortality occurs when they're caterpillars. So in the middle you have what we call a spider mite, a red velvet spider mite, eating an egg. And we sat and watched that spider mite just eat that whole egg, just suck it dry. There are bugs that eat them. There's a wheel bug in the middle eating the little one, a spine-shouldered stink bug, the scary-looking one up in the upper right-hand corner. Ants eat monarchs, and they have these really interesting predators. This fly on the bottom looks like a house fly, but it lays its eggs on monarch caterpillars. The eggs hatch into these maggots. And instead of a monarch, you get maggots coming out of the monarch. So this is why it takes a lot of milkweed to raise a monarch, because most of them die. Now, there are a lot of milkweed species that are native to North America, and one of the handouts that I passed around is something produced by the Monarch Joint Venture, which I'm the chair of. So we've identified milkweed species that people can grow, that we know are used by monarchs in all regions of the country. And you can see in this picture, and also in the handout, that some milkweeds are really beautiful. It's not just the common kind that if you grew up on a farm, you used to go out and pull out of your fields. There are some really beautiful milkweed plants that grow all over the country, including in the upper Midwest. So monarchs have this very exciting and interesting biology. But that's true of a lot of species. Monarchs are unique in that they migrate, but probably we could pick any bug and it would be really interesting to somebody. But monarchs are a great flagship species. Monarchs really make connections between people and nature. When we're saving monarchs, we're saving a lot of other things. So I am very proud to say that monarchs are the state butterfly. I'm sure you all knew that. The state butterfly of our great state of Minnesota, along with six other states. We share that honor. This was signed into law in Minnesota in 1998. I'd like to take a little bit of credit for that. There was a fourth grade class in Matamidi, Minnesota. Their teacher had taken a class from me. And she asked her students, they were learning about how a bill becomes a law. She asked her students what they would like to see as a law in Minnesota, and they said they wanted the monarch to be the state butterfly. And they got it all the way here. So we have quite a connection to monarchs in Minnesota. People care about contributing scientific information to our study and our understanding of monarchs. So there's a long list here. You're not my students, so I'm not going to give you a test. But all of these programs are citizen science programs where people go out and collect data about monarchs. They volunteer their time. They volunteer their time to study them during all of those phases of the life cycle. And I just want to show you an example of one of my favorite... this was going to be a picture of the spring migration coming north. I don't know what happened to it, but it didn't show up on the slide. But it's an example of all of the dots and people spotting monarchs and us tracking the monarch migration as they move north. Sorry about that. People also preserve habitat for monarchs. They put habitat in their backyards, at their nature centers, in their fields, at state parks. So, as a biologist, I'm very interested in why people are so interested in monarchs, why many of you have probably seen and observed monarchs. One reason is they're beautiful. We care about things that are beautiful as people. They're beautiful as adults. They're beautiful as caterpillars, and they're beautiful as the pupae or the chrysalids. They're familiar. I've heard a zillion stories about people's experiences with monarchs. They start when they're babies, They continue through their adulthood. They're very interesting. We've learned a lot about monarchs. We've learned about interactions between host plants and insects. We've learned about migration. We've learned about genetics. Monarchs have taught us a lot about the natural world. And they're impressive. A monarch weighs as much as a paperclip. It can migrate all of the way to Mexico from Minnesota. People like impressive things. So we have this organism. It's really interesting. We care about it, but its numbers are declining. And one of the ways that we can assess the size of the monarch population is by looking at the area that monarchs occupy in Mexico. So hopefully you can see this yellow line on the graph. This shows you the area, and the first time that I went to the overwintering colonies was this big peak up here in 1996. It's never been that strong. You can see there's a lot of fluctuation, ups and downs due to weather and a lot of different things, but there's a very obvious and biologically and statistically significant downward trend in monarch numbers. In Minnesota, we've named this as a species of greatest conservation need. We have this statistically valid decline. We can document habitat loss for monarchs, habitat degradation, and the Minnesota population represents a significant portion of the North American breeding population. Monarchs have been submitted. There's a petition with the Fish and Wildlife Service right now to list monarchs as an officially endangered species. Our goal is that this doesn't have to happen, that we keep them off the endangered species list. So what's happening with monarchs? Why do we have this large decline? In the United States, we're losing a lot of habitat. We're losing habitat to real estate development, energy development. You can see a picture in the top of this slide of a real estate development. We're losing acres of native prairie that are being converted to cropland. And all of this land contained habitat that was used by monarch butterflies, milkweed and nectar plants. There was just a paper published out of the University of Wisconsin, that documented net cropland increase in the United States. We've increased cropland by 2.98 million acres, and most of this came from grassland that used to be monarch habitat. We've lost a lot of milkweed that used to grow within corn fields and soybean fields, the milkweed that some of us remember pulling out when we were children. But it turns out, we did a study in 2000, a lot more monarchs came out of these corn fields and soybean fields than came out of natural habitat. And this habitat is now gone because of the use of Roundup Ready crops. So this is a big cause of the decline. You can see in this bottom picture, a little milkweed plant after the Roundup was sprayed, and that's gone. Now, I'm not dissing ag here. We're an agricultural state. That's really important to us, but this is what we have to make up. We have to make up for the habitat we've lost due to changing agricultural practices. So here you see the increase in herbicide-tolerant crop use in the United States. There are other things going on. We're losing overwintering habitat in Mexico to logging. So you can see pictures of logging here. Insecticides kill monarchs. This is a picture of a monarch that was killed by permethrin, which is used to kill mosquitoes. Climate change is a factor. We're having more and more frequent storms in Mexico that kill the monarchs, but drought up here is also hard on monarchs. I had a guy call me a couple weeks ago, and he said it's collision with vehicles. Cars hit them when they're driving down the highway, and that's what kills all the monarchs. There are diseases that monarchs get. This is a disease. The little football-shaped things in this picture are little spores from a disease that monarchs get. So the question becomes, what do we do about this? This organism that people care about, that's really interesting to us. And what I'm here to convince you today of is that conservation requires action. We need to address this habitat loss that's occurring because of changing agricultural practices. So what we need to do is make up for that habitat in other places. We need to put nectar and milkweed in the ground. In this top picture, you might think is kind of a weird one to be in a talk about monarchs, but that's actually a milkweed field. That's a production of milkweed seeds in that picture. We need to educate and advocate, and what's so important to monarch conservation is that public and private land is going to be key to monarch survival. And the good news with this is that monarchs and the milkweed that they depend on can thrive in urban and suburban areas. So what we're here to talk about is increasing the funding that's available for organizations to get milkweed into the landscape in urban and suburban areas. And finally, even though I've been studying monarchs for over 30 years, I know there's a lot else out there besides monarchs. But by creating this habitat for monarchs, we can support lots of other organisms, including pollinators, that are so important to us. So, a really quick introduction to monarchs. I really thank you for the privilege of being able to speak to you today about this. And we'll entertain questions, but I know you're at the end of a long committee meeting, so thank you.
Well, thank you. Anyone have any butterfly-related questions or comments? Well, I'll just make one. In my my fall as a sixth-grade entomologist.
Your autumn or your fall, your downfall?
Well, it was autumn. I really had a good insect collection. I got an A in that class.
Good.
Whoa. But I have one still vivid memory from that autumn. I was on a farm looking for, I don't know if I was, I probably already had my monarch, but I was looking for butterflies, and went out in a pasture, well, it was near a pasture, and there was a tree literally filled with monarchs. I mean, from top to bottom, it was every branch, it was just one big monarch. And I imagine that's what you're talking about, like in Mexico. I have never seen it before or since here, but...
it's an amazing phenomenon. So that you were seeing a fall roost. I mean, that's a real exciting thing to see. So those monarchs were kind of collecting on that tree. We don't know how they find the trees, how they find each other, but that's what people see along the migration, and that's what we want. We want other sixth-grade budding entomologists to be able to see that.
So they then left from that tree and went to Mexico?
Yeah, they were on their way to Mexico. You saw. Must have been.
I saw the little sombreros and everything. It was kind of cute. All right. Enough of that. Anything else? Comments, questions? Well, thank you very much for that presentation. It's, I think, valuable for us to have that information and awareness.
Good.
I'm getting milkweed seeds for home.
Good. That's what we need.
All right, let's see. As we begin to now put things together, just, you know, through this week, well, the schedule, I guess next Monday, we'll be hearing from Representative Torkelson on the Clean Water Council. And then after that, we will be having the bill put together and presented, so it'll be 2 weeks from yesterday. Couple of just items for your awareness. I have a couple: the Historical Society bill, the Minnesota Arts Board bill. The Historical Society, I think, is for $41 million. The Arts Board for, well, if we figured out the 47% of $122 million, which is what we have in arts, history, culture, I believe it's 57.35%. Those bills will be vehicle bills for putting this together. Also, you know, there are some other bills we'll be looking at. One just brought to me this morning, which we're not going to have time to hear, but I think is going to be included in the Senate, and that is a from Parks and Trails, a statewide comprehensive plan for off-road vehicles. So that might be something that the Senate includes. We'll talk more about that later. One other item that I would like to give a minute or so to, and that's to Representative Freiberg on a request that just was coming late last week dealing with the state band. So would you care to educate us as to that difficulty that they are facing? It's not just money, but the Representative Kahn had the bill asking for some funding. This is more of a policy issue.
You're correct, and I'll just stay here since this is, if that's with the chair's indulgence.
Sure.
I think we discussed this a little bit when we had the hearing for Representative Kahn's bill, so I'll keep it very short, but I do have a bill, House File 192, which is separate from Representative Kahn's funding bill, but this was an issue brought to me by a constituent, and I think we talked about this aspect of it, actually, when we talked about Representative Kahn's bill, too, so I'll keep it even shorter. The band has been practicing in the MnDOT cafeteria after hours for decades now, and were recently informed by the Department of Administration that they would have to vacate the premises because there was no formal agreement. They were able to get that put off pending a decision from the legislature. The Department of Administration specifically said that they would prefer that the legislature specify that the band be allowed to practice there and be given storage space. So that's so that they were under operating orders from the legislature that's what they had to do. So that's what the bill does.
Okay, thank you. And that might be something that we will.
Yeah, and we'd be certainly interested in having it included, I think, in the bill as well. I mean, certainly along with Representative Kahn's, whatever you decide to end up doing as far as the funding question goes, hopefully the issue of rehearsal space and storage space can be there as well.
Representative Kahn.
We need what we're missing is we're missing Representative Mary Murphy here to tell us about her trip visiting Europe along with the state band and so forth. But one of the things...
She told us that story, I believe.
Oh, okay. Well, we need to repeat it. one of the things that we need to do is that it turned out in this big fuss about throwing them out is that we've talked about the state band. They've been called the Minnesota State Band. We've nowhere in state law named. So we do have to also do that. We have to make them the Minnesota State Band, even though...
I mean, they are, but it doesn't say they are anywhere?
Right.
How do they become the state band?
I don't know. They just did it without getting into state law. Now we have to put them into state law.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and members, I question that there's other good bands in Minnesota. You know, we've got Prince, and we've got Trampled by Turtles. There might be, the Senate might have a position on this. So, my daughter's in a couple bands. They're not that good yet, but who knows?
Well, this is the one that's been housed by the state. And
so I'm not sure this band, we should have a band on.
We don't want, this is not a dueling band thing here.
I'm not sure that I would support this band. Prince.
Well, we will, certainly consider this and look at it for possible inclusion. And because I'm very concerned, we'll call this the Band-Aid bill.
Well, if Representative Lilly can bring Prince here to testify about how he wants his band named the state band, I think we'll easily consider that at this point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Representative Lilly, you care to make that call?
That's what we call a heavy lift at the legislature.
All right. Representative Green, any further closing comments?
Mr. Chair, seeing as how you asked. No.
All right. If there is nothing else to come before us, well, King, this case is closed.